When you golf in Missouri, the courses are so close, you'll spend more time on the fairway than the freeway. Reserve a tee time at the Regal Osage National, designed by the king himself, Arnold Palmer. Take a cart ride on the wild side in the breathtaking surrounds of Payne's Valley, designed by Tiger Woods. And after the back nine, there's still world-class dining and distilleries, shops and spas, museums and more. Find your new golf MO in Missouri. Start planning your golf getaway at visitmo.com.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies both on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Hey everybody, welcome to Friends from Work. If you're just joining us, this is a podcast where we talk about all things in the Marvel Cinematic Universe and sometimes things that aren't in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I'm Kyle Sconewill.
I'm Robbie Earl.
And this is an episode where we're going to be talking about Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. But before we get started, I just wanted to say, wasn't it kind of fun having Kyle Cousins join us in the Guardians of the Galaxy 1 episode last week, Rob?
It was very fun. I felt a little outnumbered as the only non-Kyle in the group, but other than that, it was a great experience.
I still need to get a picture of him in that full getup to share.
Oh, absolutely. Can we kind of moving forward, like why today can we not have someone that looks, you know, strikingly like Yondu?
I'm not sure I have anyone in my life that looks like Yondu.
I know. I feel like it would also be a little unnerving if we did have anybody in our lives that looked like Yondu.
Maybe just paint anyone blue.
Right. No, it was great having Kyle around. Guardians is such a fun kind of different universe within the MCU to explore.
It's true.
And
there is such a fun childlike Star Wars vibe to these Guardians movies that I just really enjoy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, let's talk about Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 though.
Yes. Okay, so Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 came out in 2017. It was preceded by Doctor Strange, followed by Spider-Man Homecoming to give people sort of an idea of the release order. However, as we've said multiple times, James Gunn is insistent about the fact that Guardians Volume 2 is supposed to take place, I mean, like right after the first one.
We had this discussion, but we landed on it takes place months later.
Yeah, that feels
right. Because if
to
you
me.
Notice at the very beginning of the movie, it starts in 1980, then it says 34 years later, which puts it at 2014, but it can't be directly after because there's some character development that's clearly happened.
Right.
You know,
and
relationships.
Groot's grown a bit.
And Groot's grown a bit.
Yeah.
So I feel like months after is the right way to do it. But also, I really enjoyed watching them back to back, I must say.
Yeah, I think it works really well. And
I think it's easier just to stay in this universe, like this realm, for a little bit, then go right back to Earth.
Right. Yeah, I like viewing this as kind of like a two-parter. And then I think whenever we do meet up with the Guardians again, pretty far down the road in Infinity War, you do get the sense there that a lot of time has passed between Guardians 2 and that. So I think that in some ways, I think this is one of the biggest wins in our watch order versus release order.
Yeah.
Just because I think that we're experiencing it the way that we should be. But cast-wise, you know, we're pretty much keeping the same core cast. The main additions here are Pom Klementieff as Mantis and Kurt Russell as Ego.
Yes.
Who I really love both of those performances. I think they're really great additions to the mythos here.
Absolutely.
Kyle, this is one that almost since the beginning you and I have kind of fought on because generally I would say you are more of a Guardians fan than I am, just the team as a whole. But I am a bigger fan of this movie specifically than you are, historically at least. I have not gotten your thoughts this latest rewatch.
I would say that's accurate, and we truly have not talked about this yet. So I'm excited to share with you what is different for me this time around.
I know. This is one of those that I've been pretty eager to get your feedback on.
There's no lie. I had this one kind of circled in my brain for a while, for real. And we haven't talked about it yet. So I'm really excited to share with you what I gathered this time around.
So let's get into it.
Yeah.
I am a big fan of this one. I feel like, you know, in terms of humor, in terms of heart, in terms of character development, I just think, I'm not saying it's a perfect movie, but in a lot of ways, this hits like all the notes that I want out of an MCU film. I mean, like even from the opening scene, it's super fun, but you also are kind of getting this family dynamic that's developed within the Guardians. Like I love the ELO song and Baby Groot dancing.
Yes.
And I think that the jokes there are really funny with Drax. I mean, it's like we're seeing this kind of level of comfort with the team that, you're right, does make me feel like at least a bit of time has gone by.
Mm-hmm.
I like some of the really early interactions that you get, you know, with Rocket and Quill that kind of show that there's been tension building there. I just think that it's like a great second team movie to me, just almost from the get-go, like picking back up with them. I don't know how you feel about that.
Oh, so you're doing guns now? I thought swords were your thing and guns are my thing, but whatever.
Skin is just as thick from the inside.
Yeah, right. It doesn't make any sense. I love Chris Pratt's performance in this movie. I love his delivery of the jokes as far as what I was just saying, where he either does like the really subtle humor, I'm too cool for school thing, or he does the yelling a lot. It doesn't even make any sense. That's my freaking father. Like all those things. Yes. I love that delivery there. I think he's really good in this movie. I agree with the family dynamic. I really like that part of it too. But I think sometimes Chris Pratt's performance can almost get lost in all the jokes and the fun and the color. I don't know if that makes sense, but sometimes it's worth pointing out that he's very good again.
Totally, both comedically and dramatically.
Yes, that's the big key for me always. You know that from last episode.
Well, because one of our top eight moments several weeks ago was a moment at the end of Guardians 2 with Quill saying, "You shouldn't have killed my mom and squished my Walkman." And there's a lot of...
My number four moment was Chris Pratt in Guardians 1. So,
right.
Yeah, he's definitely up there for me.
Before we totally move on from this scene, I also just want to say, maybe it's just my humor, but I think the whole Harbulary batteries joke
is
very funny.
That's not like, even
it
close
always
to
makes
what
me
I
laugh
said.
Out loud.
Yeah, and they kind of carry that all the way through, which I love.
Yes.
There's like
I love whenever
references.
Like later on Drax is correcting.
Yes.
And then the other thing, just kind of from early on in the film that I noted, I really like the way that they reintroduce Nebula and also kind of show what the Guardians have been doing, like a little bit of the amount of time that's passed. Like they've kind of been trying to get Nebula since the end of the last film.
Yes.
And so I think that's pretty well executed.
Nebula is interesting for me. I feel like we're getting there with her. I'm still not there with her. I really feel like Infinity War Endgame version of Nebula is my favorite. It's a more mature Nebula. It's a calmed down Nebula.
Yeah.
But my wife, who is a twin, has a twin sister, really connects with the sisterly story of Nebula and Gamora. So I've always been careful to judge that because it doesn't really hit home with me, but I'm sure it does with a lot of people. But I just feel like we're not quite there with her yet. But I do like the introduction plot-wise, what you're saying, to them trying to get her.
I think it's a hard character, and we maybe talked about this last time, but you know, the character is supposed to be so kind of emotionally dead, but also kind of in a rage at the same time. So it's like it's a strange line for her to have to toe. And I think generally Karen Gillan does a good job with the character.
Okay, here's the thing. I think she does a good job at that. Like we said last week, she's doing a good job acting that part. Just within the movie, I don't think I'm supposed to like her that much. you know what I'm saying? Within the context of the MCU, the character.
Yeah.
And then I like that eventually with Endgame, I end up cheering for her. And I feel like she's one of us. So I do like that development.
Yeah, I feel
that. I think Karen Gillan's doing a good job.
I do really love the big fight scene between her and Gamora. I think
that Gamora's carrying the huge gun on her shoulder.
It's so over the top and fun. It's almost like Tarantino-esque and just like how ridiculous it all is.
So over the top.
And it's, yeah, I love it. And I think that in some ways that's kind of a turning point of the movie where it just starts getting really interesting after kind of a lull. But we'll get there in a second.
Another thing I want to point out is something I pointed out in Guardians 1. I again think that James Gunn kills the overall vibe, the color, the visuals. And I just started taking notes of all the unique planets that we get again and planets that are developed with culture and people. And it's huge props to him for that because there are not many other MCU movies that do that very well.
Right.
Contraxia is really cool. That's the like Vegas party planet. That's snowing. The Sovereign, what an interesting, unique take on another race of people.
Yeah.
And that juxtaposition of when they show up and they're rolling out the carpet on the snow is really cool.
And the whole concept of them having the little like video game ships, I think, is really funny.
Again, it's very Star Wars-like in the imagination of it. Something new, something unique, something we haven't seen. Ego and his planet, such a cool new place. And Bearheart.
Yeah.
I'm repeating myself, but it feels more like Star Wars in that nature. And that's huge props for me as a sci-fi fan to this movie.
Yeah, this movie is very, arguably more colorful than even Guardians 1, which I like a lot. Yeah, you're right. It's such a far cry from some of the stuff we were getting in Phase 1.
I also do mostly agree with the humor, as you were referencing. There's a lot of funny parts. I wrote down some of them like, it's metaphorical, which I love.
I also really love, you know, you're talking about some of Chris Pratt's delivery here. Right after he finds out that he has the same power that Ego does, the first thing that he says is, I'm going to build some weird stuff.
That always
makes me
Pac-Man.
Just the way he said it.
Heather Locklear in Pac-Man, I think is what he says, So there's a lot of good moments, but I kind of want to gloss over that, to be honest, because I think the most redeeming thing about this movie is the emotional core, the dynamic between the characters, and all the scenes that aren't funny, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so that brings me actually to my biggest what works about this movie and really why I love it so much. It's this storyline with Rocket and Yondu and this growth that we get there.
Yes.
Oh, it's so good.
Well, and the whole bit about Rocket and Yondu kind of realizing they're the same person or a raccoon or whatever. They're the same people. And when you get that line of, it's because you're me. And then you fast forward that, the development you get all the way to where Rocket kind of gets his redemption by watching Yondu die and the Ravagers show up. And you get the line of Rocket saying he didn't chase them away. And it's this cool moment of him realizing he doesn't have to be a jerk. I watched a behind-the-scenes bit again, like I did last episode with this movie. And one thing I found really fascinating was when they play The Chain the first time by Fleetwood Mac, the first time, not the scene you were talking about. It's supposed to be this moment where James Gunn was saying you're realizing how broken these people are and how far they're falling apart. Like they could just fall apart on anything. And that's the scene where Rocket is being a total jerk.
Yeah.
Just a total jerk in every line. And Quill says, are you trying to get everyone to hate you? Because it's working. And they're kind of leaving and they're splitting apart. And I just thought that was cool because you get the seed planted of Rocket being a jerk and then the seed sown of him realizing he doesn't have to be all the time.
No, I love that. And, you know, we've talked about it, but the use of the chains in this movie is another one of my favorite things. I think it just runs through it in these kind of pivotal moments, and it creates the perfect vibe, I think. The soundtrack here in general is different. Like, it has a different feel than Guardians 1. And it's, you know, arguably less iconic, but I do really like the atmosphere that it creates.
I really like that first use of the chain, for sure. And I'm not going to beat a dead horse here, but Bradley Cooper again, dude.
Yeah.
Something about it, too. I just still can't hear Bradley Cooper. I can't picture him saying it. But I watched behind the scenes, and there he is doing it. So it's really him.
Right.
But no, amazing again. I'm not going to go into it. If you're wondering what I'm talking about, listen to last week's episode. But he's amazing. He pulls off a lot of emotion for just using his voice. So that's another huge plus for me.
And when we're talking about the Rocket Yondu thing, I thought it was really interesting. I had never read this, but James Gunn has said that Guardians Volume 1 is a movie about mothers, and that Guardians 2 is a movie about fathers.
Yeah, he just kissed
right.
Yeah.
But I really, you know, obviously that's at the core of this movie, and my favorite song on the soundtrack, and again, one of my favorite songs within the MCU is called Dad.
Oh, yes, yes.
It's a song that starts playing whenever Peter and Ego are throwing the ball.
It's legitimately one of the best songs, period, just straight up.
Oh, it's so good. And you know what I love that I don't think I fully noticed initially is that song starts playing sort of like the chains. It starts playing in that scene with Peter and Ego, but it really kind of reaches its crescendo and like its fullest form at the end when Yondu is saving Quill.
Right, that's why it's called
that, sacrificing himself. I know, but I'm just saying it doesn't have to, that to me is just a great detail.
We're quite a few movies into this rewatch order, and I haven't done this very much, but of all the songs to go look up Dad from Guardians of the Galaxy 2 and Black Tears from Guardians of the Galaxy 1. So those are two of the most standout
yes.
songs for me personally in the entire thing. So Dad for sure is the jam.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I think maybe generally for me, and I want to hear if you have any other things that you especially liked, but I think one thing that I was really impressed by on this viewing is how much, for all of the pieces that are at play in this movie, how much they're all tied together pretty neatly. And I think that that's really impressive. Like, for instance, the batteries that we kind of start the movie with wind up actually having a role throughout the whole movie in various ways, like even down to that's how they're able to destroy Ego, is because
and the Sovereign
Rocket,
show up still right. at the very end chasing him.
Right, right. It's, so it's like it's not, you don't get any throwaway things. Like I think there would be a temptation maybe in a movie like this to have some kind of little random mission the Guardians are going on at the beginning and then lead into the main story. Like, I feel like that's something that happens pretty often with films like this. But I think that the interconnectedness is really great here.
Yeah, for sure. One of my other favorite parts of this movie is Quill and Gamora's relationship building.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's a really good picture of where they would naturally progress from the first movie. If just months have passed, they're not 100% a couple in love yet, but there's
right.
definitely some unspoken thing. And I like how they play through that all the way to when they're fighting and Quill says, "It's my family." And then she says, "I thought you already had found your family."
Right.
There's just a lot of good growth that kind of ties in the family dynamic you brought up in the beginning. If Guardians of the Galaxy 1 is more about a bunch of jerks having to come together, this movie's about they are together and they are a family. And I really appreciate
yeah.
that about this film.
This movie feels a little bit like a Thanksgiving lunch.
It does, kind of. It does, yeah. I never would have thought that, but yes.
Yeah, I think generally, again, I like the introduction of the new characters here too. I really like Drax's relationship with Mantis.
Yes.
I like that you kind of have one really socially ignorant character with one who is super literal and overly blunt. It just makes for this kind of funny dynamic. Well, because they're really both kind of socially ignorant, but in between the two of them, Drax,
yeah,
she
right.
thinks that Drax knows about all these things that he really doesn't know about.
Right. And speaking of new characters, we have to get to one of my favorite things, Ego.
Yes.
Ego
yes.
as a villain, if you listen to our villains episode, is one of my favorite villains in the entire MCU. I think not only is Kurt Russell great, by the way, Kurt Russell looks like he really could be Chris Pratt's dad, which is kind of funny to me.
That's
casting
true.
Is
yeah.
perfect there, but he sells it, and it's a really unique character. how he's so inviting and warm and kind, as long as you're fulfilling his mission. And then if not,
right.
Yikes. And I love that about him.
Yeah.
Freaking father. I said that earlier, but I love that part when Rocket says, "You people have issues." And he says, "Of course I have issues." Right. And then you see this like skeleton nature of ego. But no, he's great. I love him.
This is an interesting villain for me because...
Do you not love Ego?
No, I do. I do. But I think on paper, I don't as much.
Oh my. I fully expected you to be on my team on that.
Well, so I'm on your team in that I think, and we've talked about this before, I think what really saves it for me is just Kurt Russell's performance. Where, again, I'm saying...
Ego give you that you were wanting?
Well, no, it's not that. It's just the character errs a bit, in my opinion, on the side of I want to take over everything just because. I mean, he literally wants the entirety of the universe to be him.
Right.
Like, that to me is the definition of power for the sake of power.
It's believable because he's a celestial to me.
Sure. But I'm just saying it's not like, you know, we necessarily have any kind of complex motive like we've talked about with Killmonger, with Thanos, or even with Loki.
I get what you're saying. The motive itself is unique because of his character being a god, I think.
Yeah, but what does he want? What does he want? Because it would be unique to me if they were like, I mean, just like it was Obadiah Stane's destiny to run Stark Industries.
No, he never said that. He never said that. It was just what he wanted.
Yeah, but I'm saying I don't know.
I hear you.
Again, Mark. I'm not complaining because it's not any... I don't mean this as a criticism, really, because I like everything about what that character ends up being, and I think that, like, you do get these really kind of touching for Quill scenes of, like, what he could have had with his actual dad. And so I think that, like, it, again, talking about how well a lot of things are interwoven here, like, I think it's the perfect villain. Ego is kind of a classic staple of the Marvel Universe. I like the way they worked him in. So I think
it's mostly the performance here, because I even read a thing about James Gunn saying the charisma of Kurt Russell makes so much sense because of him being Peter Quill's dad. He has the same kind of egotistical thing, no pun intended.
Literally.
But that Quill has. So that part of the performance is believable to me.
Yeah.
So I do think most of my compliments are performance related, not motive related. And this is such a funny thing, Robbie, because I want to talk about this in a Marvel Ed sometime. But I think I just lean more towards the performance and the dialogue of characters. My mind less goes towards the plot. And I think you lean a little bit more towards, does the plot make sense? And then the characters are a little bit secondary to that. Now, it's 1A, 1B. I'm not saying we both care about plot and characters, but I think that's how I can even enjoy Iron Man 2, for example, and be bothered by a movie that's maybe got a great plot, but I don't buy all the performances. So it's just funny. When I say that, I'm really referring to Kurt Russell, I think, and how much I believe he could be his dad. He is trying to take over the world. When I actually stop and think about it, I'm like, okay, yeah, plot-wise, that's not great. I get it.
Well, and it's close for me because in some ways, I agree. I mean, like a not believable performance will not really save a movie with an amazing story for me. But I do think that...
But often you bring up the plot before I do.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, my point here, and we made this comment in another movie, and I'm trying to remember which one it was, but my point is just that it's all the more impressive because I think the character is just not necessarily as interesting, but Kurt Russell's take on it makes it one of my favorite villains. So I'm just kind of giving him props there in transforming it into something that I think is actually really well done.
Yes.
So, okay, before we move on, is there anything else that you wrote down, anything that you just think really works well here?
So yeah, these are really little. These aren't major points, but they're more just moments that I really enjoyed as I was going along. I love when they're betting about Mantis's antennas. And he says, as long as it's anything besides making sure you're not decapitated by a doorway, I win. Which I love. I'm going to bounce around. Okay. This is random, but Craiglin. I really enjoy Craiglin. I enjoy his emotional distraught over what's happening with the rest of the Ravagers. Cause I feel like that's a scene that gets out of hand so fast. I like him bringing it back down to earth for me.
Just while you're there, something that I meant to bring up, I really like that scene kind of right before things get out of hand where it's just Rocket against all the Ravagers. Because that's one of the only times so far that we've just kind of seen Rocket on his own being
like tricking
a badass.
Yeah.
Like normally we see him kind of combine with Groot or, you know, just in sort of a different capacity, but that's just Rocket kind of taking everybody out. And basically if Nebula hadn't shown up, I think that there's, you know, there's an understanding that he could have made it out.
Yes. Tying in tying in the imagination thing I was talking about, the Star Wars vibe. I love the diorama display thing that Ego has when he's walking through.
Yeah.
It's unique. Thank you. You have some imagination for a sci-fi movie. Love it.
Yeah, agreed.
And then I love when Nebula, when Craiglin says, what are you going to do with the money? And she goes, I'm going to murder this. And then she goes into this whole emotional speech. And he goes, oh, I was thinking more like a pretty necklace or something. Like,
yeah, I like that scene.
I also like when he says, I'm Mary Poppins, y'all. And then he says, is he cool?
I'm so glad you said that.
That line's good, but the next line's best when he goes, hell yeah, he's cool. I love that.
Because it's just, like kind of sweet.
I know it's a sweet moment because he's not correcting that Mary Poppins is a woman. He just goes with and says, hell yeah, he's cool.
Yeah. I like that a lot.
So just to kind of put a bow on what works, let's talk about the tone the very end of the movie sets. Isn't it really unique that the movie closes with a tear coming down Rocket's eye? I mean, I don't know that we have too many other movies that have that vibe for an ending.
No. I mean, we talked about this way back. Yeah, Captain America. And really, I think like up until we get to Infinity War again, like this is more hopeful than Captain America because of what the Yondu funeral was. But still, I think what's really unique about this is that it's like, I mean, you're just sitting in the emotion of this funeral and then black screen, which is like that compared to like the ending of Guardians 1 especially, right? Where it's just like super fun and they're going off in the ship and a little bit of bad, little, you know, it's like I just think that again is the sign of a mature filmmaker in that regard.
Again, I just found it unique that the actual camera cut happens before they give us any kind of teaser at all of what's about to happen.
Yeah.
I mean, they don't tease us of, are they going off onto another mission or are they now just going to sit around depressed? We have no idea. Like it just ends. The story doesn't give us anything to leave on.
I love it. I love it. I think it's a bold call. I loved it in Captain America too.
It's very bold. It's very different. And I think I really like it too. The last thing I need to spend maybe 5 to 10 minutes on for real. One of my other favorite parts of this entire movie is there's a really distinct moment that the movie turns for me. And it's been really fun and kind of like Han Solo-y feeling adventure movie. And there's a scene where when Kurt Russell says, wish I didn't have to put that tumor in your mom's brain.
Yeah, yeah.
And exact moment when Peter goes, what? And it zooms out and he's got the tentacles going through his brain. And then at the exact moment, Mantis is saying to Drax, there's something I need to tell you. And Nebula and Gamora are finding the skeletons. And I have chills right now even describing the scene because when that all happens and you realize, oh my gosh, this guy is not just as friendly and as inviting as he comes off, something else is going on. That's when the movie really kicks into gear for me. That's when it's amazing. That realization of, oh no, this guy's got a different agenda. Oh man. And the way Peter goes, what is, it's kind of dark and it's really cool. And then his emotional response, because it's so fitting to Peter Quill's character to just go and just like shoot him a million times. He knows it probably won't kill him by just shooting him, but that anger, again, fitting and a precursor to the Infinity War reaction.
Exactly. Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Yeah.
The last 30 minutes of this movie, from the time that Yondu saves Quill through the entire funeral, is the most redeeming thing about this entire movie. It's the most meaningful death we've had to this point. Yondu's death. And the fact that the film just fully embraces the death, not just embraces it, like hugs the death, kisses the death. I mean, it goes all out with it. It's a long scene. You get the first part where it really starts moving you is when Quill gives this amazing performance of no, no, when Yondu's actually dying, okay, which is amazing.
Man. Yeah. That's a
actually, you know what? Even
me,
before
sure.
that, a thing I love is when, to speak of how much of a family they are, when Rocket is having to take off the ship and he shoots Gamora with the taser so she can't go out. And then Drax, of all people, goes, "Where's Quill? Where's Quill? Like, don't take off. We don't have Quill." That moment gives me chills. Then you get the Yondu thing. That's heartbreaking. Then you get the heartbreaking speech that Quill gives when they're actually burying Yondu, or you know what I'm talking about, at the actual funeral. And then the Ravagers showing up, that whole thing, the redemption for Kraglin, the redemption for Rocket. I mean, they really go all out with this death scene and all around it. So that part needs to be noted, because we criticize the MCU a lot for not doing that.
Yes, good point.
And here they are, not just doing it, but really going in.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm like really giving it some heft and some meaning.
I don't even know what else to say about it. I just want people to know how much I appreciate and love that part of the movie.
Yeah, it's hard for me because, and we'll get into this in a second, there are a lot of things that I don't love. I don't hate, but I don't love about the final fight between Peter and Ego.
So if I was to transition into what doesn't work from that point, one of my biggest concerns, first off, is that I feel like that 30 minutes I'm talking about, or the last like 45 minutes, has to redeem the first hour for me. I feel like the movie starts really slowly, and not a lot of things land, but I was watching that Yondu scene thinking, wow, this does make up, like this single-handedly bumps this movie up in my head. That's how much I like the ending.
So would you say then that you're not a fan of the opening scene in the way that I am?
I would say, I don't want to be a jerk. I'm sorry. This is just my critique.
Okay. No, yeah, I want to hear it.
Okay, so I've been waiting to get to this point because I've been thinking a lot about how I want to say this. I want to first say that when this movie first came out, I was legit mad at this movie. If you reference our first ever Beyond the MCU episode couple months ago, I talked about my character and how I don't want new things and whatever. Well, if you remember, this movie came out in 2017, correct?
Right.
We were so ramped up into the Infinity Saga by that point that all I was wanting was some tie, some reference, some mention of the Avengers, of Earth, of the Infinity Stones.
Because we're a year out from Infinity War at that point.
We were, and I was so in on the Infinity War saga that I got mad at this movie. I think my biggest critique was that I just left feeling so disappointed when I first saw this. Not only does it not tie in, it doesn't even address anything. I mean, it doesn't even talk about anything. So I want to come back and revisit that by saying, by watching this in this order, that solves 98% of that problem. It makes more sense to just stay in Guardians realm. And it makes more sense to remember that, look, they don't have a lot of that other background yet in 2014.
Yeah.
So it's not fair to be mad at the movie in this order, but it is fair, I think, to be mad in release order. I was so disappointed. I mean, I tanked this movie in my head score-wise because of how mad I was at it. And I know that's ridiculous. On this watch order, that concern was eased. Before you even answer that, my other major point, oh my goodness, this is such a big takeaway. I feel like for the most part, they said to themselves, hey, what worked in Guardians of the Galaxy 1? Oh, the humor worked, the emotional core worked, the color worked. And they just said, okay, we now need to turn that all up to 11. Let's dial everything up. Here we go. Turn it all up to where I feel like personally, the humor is trying too hard. It's not nearly as funny as a movie to me as the first one, because some of the jokes are just like the turd joke, right? That's an example of a joke where it's just trying too hard to be funny. You had such a good thing with Drax. Now let's make him work a little hard at it. That's how I feel with the humor. So it's not bad. It's still a funny movie. In fact, it's probably still a top five funny movie, but it's not Guardians of the Galaxy 1 funny. It's a notch down. It's the diet version of Guardians of the Galaxy. I feel the same way about the soundtrack. The soundtrack in Guardians of the Galaxy 1 was so revolutionary, so perfect. This one is fine. It's good. But I don't feel like the songs fit the vibe as well. It's hard to explain. I don't know what it is. I'm not a music supervisor, but the songs themselves don't give me the same feelings that Guardians of the Galaxy 1 did. It's better than that Captain Marvel, you know, I'm just a girl placement. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just saying it's the diet version of the soundtrack. Like, we had to dial it up, and it just comes short.
I want to push back a bit on that because, one, generally, I do agree with you, and I think if you look at the reviews from this movie, I think a lot of critics felt like it was a bit, it was like ramped up and maybe even overstuffed. And I get some of that. Sometimes whenever people ask me if I like the Deadpool movies, I always say that I think that they're funny, but I think that it's like they're just constant jokes. And I think 1 in 5 of the jokes are funny, if that makes sense. So it's like so many jokes that it's a little exhausting, but still, like 20% of them are really funny. So it's like, you know, I would probably rather just have those 20%. And I think that's a little bit of what's going on here. It's not that I think that the humor is worse, like what you do. Like, I think that the jokes are as funny, but I think that there are maybe too many of them.
Yes, yeah, that's more accurate. That's fair. So here's an example. I started the movie off by a tally. I had a Drax column, and I was going to tally how many lines in the entire movie does Drax have that are serious. I thought there was like 2. Where I was incorrect, to push back on myself, was I started tallying, and I was at like 5 or 6, and I was like, okay, I remember this wrong. A lot of this hate was because I was so mad at the movie for the other reasons.
Right.
But what I did catch is the difference between Guardians of the Galaxy 1 and this movie, side note, this happens in the later seasons of The Office as well, is that every time you give us a serious moment, they had to follow it up with a joke. Every single time. So even the comments of Drax saying, "You are beautiful," to Mantis, and then he has to say, "On the inside." They can't just let it be "you're beautiful," which would me in that moment, I don't need 100% of the time to have no jokes, but I just want there to sometimes not be a joke, you know?
So I want to table the music conversation for a second. So don't let me forget that. But while we're talking about this, one thing that I had never noticed before on Guardians 1, there were 2 writers who were credited with quote-unquote script polishing.
Oh, I like where this is going.
Do you know who those writers were?
It's got to be Christopher Marcus and Stephen McFeely.
Christopher Marcus and Stephen McFeely.
In knowing that, that makes what I'm saying so much more sense, doesn't it? It's almost came in and said, look, let's just clean this up a little bit. Just polish it. Script polishing, literally. Let's take that joke out. Let's reel this one back in. And then Guardians of the Galaxy 1, to me, is perfect. Without that, I feel like you get the bloated version of, okay, we could lose half the jokes. We could lose, I don't know, just they could have dialed it back, and that makes sense to me.
No, I think you're right. And I never, you know, we don't know what happened. We don't know what versions of the script were. We don't know how much they actually impacted Guardians 1. But I do think, you know, I do think it's interesting, right? Because what that says to me in some ways is that, you know, this was James Gunn's first film. It was with a whole set of characters that nobody knew about. I mean, I think Marvel had good reason to be nervous on Guardians 1. Well, I think what could have happened with Guardians 2, and what I think often happens with franchises, is once a director has proven himself or herself, you know, capable of making a hit, I think the studio tends to kind of give them more deference. And sometimes I think that can mean that you do get a more bloated film because you don't have people around that are really kind of putting the knife to it. And I think sometimes you do need those people. I mean, I think that's how you wind up with the Star Wars prequels or with the Hobbit movies, right? It's like whenever you give the person who really loves these characters and this material so much free rein, they're always gonna, I think, err on the side of going overboard with it.
I also think it's important to note that sometimes the attempts of going overboard are justified and they do work out. So I love what you said about the Deadpool thing about 20% of the jokes work, because sometimes some of these things, the same thing I'm praising James Gunn for example, this movie goes, you know, dials it up to 11 as far as what I was talking about, the culture and the planets and the color. I mean, the quantum asteroid field, for example, is a really crazy imagination plot point he dialed up, and I like it. So that's where I know it's hard, is that there are some of the things that he dialed up that work.
And like the Yondu.
But I think it's also, and the Yondu thing, like they really dialed up Yondu's funeral. Really did. And that's the best thing about the movie. So, you take some of the good with the bad, I guess, is my point. I understand what they're trying to do, but there are some things where it's like, the humor in particular, you didn't need to do that.
Yeah. I mean, I do like to think that Marcus and McFeely had an impact on that first film, because, I mean, we've talked about how just a lot of my favorite movies, I mean, most of my top five list is composed of Marcus McFeely movies. And I just really like their kind of sensibility. I feel like they have a good sense of timing. And I think that stuff does come through in Guardians a lot in a way that I'm not sure it always does in Volume 2. I did want to say on the music point, I see what you're saying, and it is subjective. I just disagree. I think that some of the music in Guardians 1, I mean, it was revolutionary in the sense that pairing that style of music with those kinds of scenes just hadn't been done in that way. But I think that in some ways the soundtrack here is a bit more unexpected. It's kind of less obvious. Like, you had some kind of deep cuts in Guardians 1 with Hooked on a Feeling. But I mean, like, Come and Get Your Love and Ain't No Mountain High, like, those aren't especially, like, crazy song choices. Whereas I think that, like, ELO and The Chain, well, again, like, they're very popular songs. I think that they're, like, a little bit weirder. And I think it fits with the kind of weirder tone of this movie. Like, the settings are kind of weirder. I mean, the whole villain story is weirder. And I don't know. I think that the soundtracks for both movies are very appropriate. I don't think that this one was in any way a misfire, but that's just me.
The only part where I'd say agree to disagree is just that I do think it's good. The Chain placement, especially the first one for me, and the ELO song, those really work as good as Guardians 1. I think Guardians 1 was flawless on every one, and I would say this one was not perfect on every one.
So this is the second time, though, that I feel like you've specifically highlighted the first time. So do you not feel like this is the second placement works as well?
Yeah, I don't feel the second one as much as you do, and I hate that I'm saying that. I don't feel that scene like you do. It's not even close to the Guardians of the Galaxy, where the Guardians of the Galaxy scene in one. I do like it. I don't know if it's the music in particular, or if, like you said, some of the battle between Peter and Ego at the end is a little off for me. Doesn't quite connect. It's not bad. None of this is bad. I like this movie. It's not quite the same level.
Well, I mean, so it's interesting because if we're comparing it to the moment in Guardians 1, one big difference is that moment in Guardians 1 culminates in that Black Tears theme that you love so much.
I love
whereas
so much.
This scene is a pop song, which I think could kind of impact how much you feel like the moment is dramatic versus kind of epic. Or dramatic versus just kind of fun. But I don't know, like, for me, there's something about, I mean, I just think it's one of my favorite placements, with the way, like, the beat coming in as he's, like, hitting Ego, and then you see all the Guardians that are kind of on the verge of death are now escaping because of Quill being able to fight back. I think it's like it's a very cool moment to me. Like, the song makes it feel kind of like Quill's a badass, like this kind of Han Solo thing is going on again. I don't know. I like it a lot. But, you know.
As part of this soundtrack conversation, I do want to point out that although I do think there are some tracks that don't quite live up to their potential, the Cat Stevens song at the end, not only lyrically, but the tone it gives, is it makes me emotional thinking
about
it.
I'm so glad you said that, because
that's the best placement maybe they've had in this entire film to me.
When this movie came out, I went around listening to this song on repeat because I just wanted to recapture the feeling that it gave me after this movie. Because you're right. It's, oh man, that moment hits so hard because of that. Thank you for bringing that up.
You're welcome. My overall takeaway was there's so much good directly followed by bad. That was my takeaway. There's so many things I like, and then they immediately give me something to remind me, it's not perfect. I have a couple other things that I didn't... These are comical notes, okay? Why not dispose of Yondu's prototype Finn? They know it's in the drawer. Why even leave it as an option that Yondu might get and kill everyone on the ship?
Yeah, that doesn't bother me because
you
I feel like...
You think they're trying to test on it or what?
I mean, I think that they... One, I think that we're supposed to get the sense that they're not super smart.
For sure.
And it's two, metaphorical. I think that they probably think that it's something that they could sell, that it's valuable, right? Rather than just like throw it away.
The other thing I'm laughing about is how many guys are on that ship? Because first they show like
so many
hundreds of dead bodies floating in the in space. Then there's still like 50 people in like the Groot torture scene. And then at the very end, Yondu kills like 4,000 people. I mean, it's a huge ship, very populated.
Very populated.
Okay, let's talk about what was foundational and kind of the mythos of this movie and how it's going to impact some of the things going forward.
Yeah.
Even though I complained about earlier, there's one reference to Thanos that I really love when Nebula says she's going to go hunt down and kill Thanos, and Gamora looks at her really defeated and says, I don't know if that's possible. Again, just establishing in the background, there's this guy out there that is unbeatable.
Yeah.
I love that going forward.
Yeah, and I do like that here. And I think kind of in general, I like kind of where this movie leaves certain characters based on where we're going to pick up with them again several years later in Infinity War. Like, I think that one of the biggest things for the Infinity Saga in this movie is the growth in Gamora and Nebula's relationship.
Yes. Well, and the development between most of the characters is so important because this is the last we're going to see them before Infinity War. So I need them to be a fully developed team, family, before I see how is that family interact with our Avengers family. And this movie does that really well. And it's important to note, yes, like you said, where Gamora and Nebula are left, where Gamora and Quill are left.
And more with having 4 years between, because at the very end of Guardians 2, you have kind of this slight indication from Gamora that she is, you know, that she has these feelings for Quill.
Right.
And then whenever we see them in Infinity War, which in release order was a year later, they're suddenly, you know, like full on soulmates. And so knowing that, you know, they've now been in a relationship for 4 years since the end of Guardians 2 really makes that resonate more too.
Yep. It's important to note that Quill has really gone through it by the time we get to Infinity War.
Oh, good point. Yeah.
He loses his mom. He gets sucked up by an alien ship. He has a really weird relationship with his temporary dad of Yondu. He does not know his real dad. When he meets his real dad, he's a psycho. And then he loses Gamora ultimately. So by that time, man, Quill's gone through it. And again, it makes his emotional response to Thanos more believable.
Totally. And
you know what other scene it really helps? When Thanos is holding Gamora saying, shoot her, you promised to me. Oh,
yeah. Yeah. And I like that they kind of recognize that the writers, who again are Marcus and McFeely when you're talking about Infinity War, recognize that,
I'm still waiting for Agent Coulson to be brought up somehow. Or Thor Dark World somehow.
His spirit, Coulson's spirit hovers yes. above us now. But I like that they recognize that Quill has gone through all this because we get that little contest between Quill and Thor about basically who's gone through the most in recent years.
Yes, so true. Wow, what another interesting parallel between these Guardians movies and Ragnarok. That's interesting. They basically have gone through the same thing as characters.
Yeah.
They're competing who's gone through the most.
In terms of what else is big, just the introduction of Mantis winds up being significant. I mean, she plays a pretty big role in Infinity War, especially, and basically kind of becomes part of the team.
Does the fanboy in you get a little bit bummed knowing that Peter gives up his godness.
Thank you. Yes.
I get why it makes 100%. I love that he's emotionally choosing, you know, what's so wrong with that when he says you're going to be mortal and all this stuff. And I love that. It's such a cool moment. But fanboy wise, that God part would be really helpful against Thanos.
Right. I mean, he probably could have single-handedly taken Thanos down if he had that ego power.
He would have had to develop that skill for sure more.
But
there's something cool about when what do you describe those tentacles are going through his head and he realizes his power and that he's a part God. Yes. That's dope.
It does, you're right. The fanboy, I think it's ultimately the right call because I think Star-Lord is cooler as, like I said, like a real Han Solo figure. Yeah.
He's not the strongest Avenger, and that's okay.
Yeah, we don't want him to be Thor.
No, we don't.
We have Thor. Right. But I...
Just a little part of you, though. Just a little bit.
It hurts a little bit because it was such a cool part of the end of Guardians.
Yes.
Is this, like, he can hold the Power Stone on his own because he has this kind of strain of something really interesting. So I kind of hate that that's just gone now. But, no, I'm glad you said it. I think it's better. It makes him more interesting as a character. Let's leave the Guardians and we'll catch back up with them way down the road. But for now, it is Kyle's favorite part of the show.
I do love this part. I love lists. I love lists.
Let's talk scores. I'm really excited to hear yours. But I feel like that'll be a bit more climactic. So maybe I'll start with mine.
Okay, go.
So I went into this movie, I think my score stayed the same, actually. Although now that we've kind of gotten past phase one, you know, we've talked about this, it gets really hard to rank these. Like, we're getting into some really, really good movies. And so it's just like you're dealing with a lot of 1A, 1B, whatever. So for me, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 gets an 85.
Oh, wow. Oh, you're going to love this then.
It's an 85. That's ranked 15 out of 23 for me.
Oh, my goodness. Are you kidding me? We sat here and argued about this movie, about how I didn't like it. Okay, so, oh, my gosh. All the things that I said I didn't like. What the heck? You're going to love this. Okay. It has 84% Rotten Tomatoes. Okay. I think it's a good movie. I really do. I there's a lot I like about it. As you know, I already like the characters a lot. So I'm invested in this film. When I first saw it, I was mad at it. I was so mad at it, I gave it a 72% when I first saw it.
Wow.
I moved it all the way up to an 83%. So after all that, you know, arguing, and what's funny is 83 for me is 12 out of 23. So I have this movie ranked higher than you after all of that. Which is so funny. To the audience, we took such an approach of like, well, I know Robbie loves this movie and Kyle doesn't like it, so we better, you know, see how that goes. And now we get to the end and I haven't ranked higher than you. So that's truly a revelation.
That's why it's so fun not having talked to you about this before we record. I like that I didn't know that because I'm pretty shocked right now. But that's great. I love it.
I think what's important for people to note is that our scales of the number are a little different. You in general just have the numbers higher than me. Like if 85 is your 15, that's just higher.
Right, right.
I'm a little closer to more of a Rotten Tomatoes score in general, a little bit lower. So like 83 would be a very good movie. If I was defining this, I would say 60 to 70 is watchable, but not very good. It's not stand out. 70, 80 is you leave the theater feeling like that's a good movie. If you're 80 to 90, that's like a movie you tell people about, you know, like this is a good film. 90 to 100 is the upper echelon. It's amazing. I'm going to do a podcast about it. Right.
Yeah.
So
right.
83 so, I mean, for me. Yeah. So we're in the same range though, but 12 out of 23 for me.
I think for me, you know, I mine is similar to like a Rotten Tomatoes scale, although I think I've been thinking of this as something of a closed universe, and my like favorite, and like there are so many good MCU films, in my opinion, that my favorites are going to be nearly perfect. So I feel pretty comfortable having them close to the 100 mark. I don't have one at 100, but I have a few that are hovering there, you know? And so
to me,
it is, but you know, it changes from movie to movie, and we'll see that as we get going. But my...
Right.
my 90s are interesting.
Well, and my last caveat I want to give is that could change again. The score won't change, but the placement is going to be really tight with a bunch of other tier two movies that they're all kind of the same area. And so depending on how I feel with this rewatch, it might change 12 to 15 to 10, you know, whatever. So
right. What are your tiers, by the way, like in terms of like where does your first tier end number-wise?
To me, as of now, there's a really big gap between 90 and 84 between Winter Soldier and the next movie. So there's a big fall off there.
Oh, interesting. And then okay. And so then what number is that?
There's 10 movies that I would say if you said any of these 10 are in the first tier, anywhere between, you know, 88 to 100, I would never right. fight you. I would never argue you. But if you say any of these movies below that, that's where I'm like, well, I don't agree. So,
right.
And then I think there's a really noticeable drop off from like this range of movie. Like I would say 80 and below are obviously not as good.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
So my tiers, I guess, are kind of 50 to 80% being low, 80 to 90 being middle, and then 90 to 100 being best.
Okay. No, that's good to know. Because I like your tier system. I don't really use that, but I think that's helpful in a lot of ways.
Well, just because there are some movies that are pretty much interchangeable.
Yeah. Yeah.
In my mind.
Well, good. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, there you go. Another rankings explanation, Marvelette, in the middle of this episode. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Friends from Work is now on iHeartRadio, as well as Apple Podcasts, Spotify, other places, Stitcher, I think, Google Play. You can subscribe to us. You can leave us a review if you feel inclined. It helps us.
Only if you like it, though.
Only if you like it. If you hate it, don't say anything. I'm just kidding. if you do hate it, reach out to us first on social media. At the FFW podcast. Then we can argue with you there first and we'll troll there. and on Spotify, you can follow us and it makes getting the podcasts easy for you. I think they get downloaded directly to your phone, which makes you have to check every week. That's the way to do it. At the FFW podcast and subscribe to us all those places. We are so happy to be at this point with you guys. We are looking forward to some really, really, really good movies as we move forward in this phase two and phase three. Thank you for listening. We love you. This has been Friends from Work.
Live on DAZN Worldwide, May 2nd and 3rd, Garcia versus Romero and Canelo versus Skull. Friday from 6 p.m. Eastern, Garcia returns in a history-making Times Square takeover. 24 hours later, Saturday from 7 p.m. Eastern, King Canelo faces undefeated Skull for the undisputed crown. May 2nd and 3rd, a knockout weekend of boxing. Pick one or go all in for only $90, exclusively on DAZN. Buy now at DAZN.com/boxing.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.